Welcome everyone to the Caribbean Science Fiction Network, a celebration of all things fantasy, folklore, speculative fiction, and of course, science fiction.
And I feel like this sort of power and this magic that the Haitian people have and how they've sort of been able to kind of free themselves and imagine possible futures outside of the current model of our planet.
On today's show, I have from Haiti, Fabrice Guerrier. We'll be talking about a few stories as well as Medusa's descendants.
A lot of it has manifested through sort of this exploration of what Haitian futurism mean and kind of shifting the conversation.
Fabrice, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm honored to be in conversation in your show and explore all of the different facets of the Caribbean sci-fi world.
Thank you so much for being here. For those who may not know about you, unfortunately for them, but they will get to know you today. As someone born and raised in Haiti, describe how you came to what I would call CSF or Caribbean SF.
Absolutely. I think it's almost a... It's interesting because usually I kind of claim this in the West. We tend to sort of separate and compartmentalize and like atomize aspects of the lived experience. And I think for me, growing up in Haiti, I didn't really make a difference between the surreal or the fantastical and the types of futures that existed. But it wasn't until like me as an adult sort of looking backward. Yeah. So, and I'm sure you've heard that a lot of times, but it's like the idea of believing in ghosts and spirits, or the idea of like, of meaning and transformation through dreams, or the idea of ancestorship, the power that there is an unbroken connection to your ancestry. And as I live in the present moment, I can tap into the past and the future. So I feel like for me, it was very much like a natural state of being and a natural state of like perceiving the world, this sort of fantastical, futuristic, historical lens. But I think when I moved to the US when I was 13, I was almost forced to let go of that because a lot of this sort of immigrant journey demands of us to sort of conform and engage and sort of push ourselves within an economic, social, educational sort of pathway where we have to adapt and we have to get a certain grade, we have to get these certain check boxes in order to be well adjusted in the economy. And I think there is a loss that happened for me internally. And it really, I think there are different sprinkles of things that I experienced throughout my life, but it wasn't like in high school, for example. I always say that I was working at a library and I was surrounded by books. And while I didn't speak the language, I didn't speak the English. English is my third language and I was learning it. And a lot of that process was very alienating because when people don't really understand you or you don't really understand the culture, you're sort of like an alien. Yeah. And I think the library was a space for me to expand my mind, to explore. And I think as I grew older, the science fiction, fantasy, the sort of mythological space became a space for me where I could breathe and I could sort of reach back to my younger self and kind of say, hello, like I've forgotten you. And because I've kind of gone into this sort of very sort of prototypic way of living. So I think Caribbean science fiction and fantasy, all of that was as an adult kind of naming that, putting a sort of a symbol, a symbolism around what that means in the West was almost for me a way to like realign to something that I already was. And it allowed me to breathe, allowed me to exist, allowed me to grow, it allowed me to heal and allowed so many different things.
you mentioned ancestorship, conformity, loss, and I see these themes coming up throughout your work. What kind of memories you're able to share with us that were kind of activated during your writing process, and how that sort of spurred on your style of SF?
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of it is like, again, I think it's a journey as well, because I remember my first initial stories that I would write, a lot of them were white characters. They were like mainly white characters. And I think there was a sort of consciousness where I started to realize, it's like, why am I writing white characters? It's because everywhere I looked in society, whether in films, whether in TV, which I experience art very visually as well, started to be like, how do I own more of my voice, more of my existence? And I think giving myself permission to to write through the Black experience, to write through the Black lens, and oftentimes this sort of identity that has been sort of crushed or been framed as an alien in a way, or maybe not has been elevated in society. I almost felt that a lot of it was like, I have an entire world of like growing up in Haiti and in my family. And a lot of those energies sort of started to sort of rise more and more and more. And I think when you tap into your, like those sort of original mythology, there's a certain voice that you start to claim. And I'm not saying that I've claimed that artist's voice, but I do feel that like that voice is becoming more and more and more like, is playing a stronger role in my like writing. I think in terms of memory, I feel like there's so many different layers to that. I feel like as a child, I really connected with the natural world. I always say the natural world was like my first teacher, like being in the yard and like taking in a little bit of a caterpillar, for example, and putting the caterpillar in a matchbox and then taping it up. In a couple of days, it becomes a cocoon, and you take out the cocoon and you see the cocoon's wiggling. And then a few days later, it bursts out into a beautiful monarch butterfly that's able to sort of travel like hundreds of miles in a migration around the planet. It's just kind of like wondering, what is this force that is kind of tying that beauty, tying that natural space? And I had a lot of questions, and I feel like those types of natural experiences were very sort of supernatural in a sense, because I didn't quite see it through the lens of like, oh, this is a scientific thing, this happens, but it was very magical. Like it's like, or a tadpole in a basin forming legs and then becoming a frog. And then that frog just like erupting after like a rainstorm, and you hear them everywhere. I don't know. I think there's a kind of magic in living on the island that I feel like I've lost because I'm like in a major city. I'm not surrounded by nature at all. I think, yes, there could be trees. Yes, there could be mountains and hikes and stuff, but it's not the same. Like I don't have a mango tree that I can like pluck fresh mangoes from at any time of the day. I don't have an avocado tree that I can pluck at any time of the day. I think there is a mythology, an early mythology, that once I started to sort of claim that and just realign with it outside of what the world wanted me to be, I think a lot of those things start to sort of manifest in my writing specifically.
We're going to talk about the mangoes, because I really want to talk about that. Before we get there, one of these stories, it's part of the, what you call the Caribbean Sky Islands project, and more broadly, the publishing house Syllable. Talk to us about both of those, and how did it emerge, and how do you see it as functioning within that, let's say, the SF space, the Caribbean SF space?
Absolutely. I think I'll begin. I think for me, what I've realized is like there is a sort of dichotomy in the West where a lot of the individuality, and I spoke at it again, it's like there's an autonomization that happens in the individual, where it's like, this is my rights, this is my way, this is my vision of the world. But I think in this individualization, there's a lot of things that are sort of lost. And I think for me, like juxtaposing like my neighborhood, for example, where I grew up in Haiti, like I knew my neighbors, I hung out with my neighbors. Like we celebrated our birthday parties together. We did a lot of different things on a very communal basis. And I feel like when I moved here, a lot of that was like, it almost seemed like the over-glorification of the lone genius is something that is so inherent in our society. And I feel like that myth is so damaging. And I think for me as a writer, I lived into that myth. I believed that myth. And I feel like when I moved to, when I was at Florida State University, like I started an organization called the League Institute. It was a social venture and a think tank where we brought like professors, different students from different academic background, and they collaborated through like simulation and writing. And I think a lot of many ways, the League Institute was very much a precursor to Syllable, because when I started to claim more and more and more of my writing that I wanted to be a writer, that I am a writer, that I see things very differently than others in the world, I think that was a very lonely experience, writing by myself. And I think a lot of that experience stemmed from my experience going back to Haiti as a Pen American, Pen Haiti fellow with the Pen, Pen America in New York. And I work with the Pen Haiti Center. And I think that was there where I wrote my first two horrible novels. And that like really expanded my consciousness. So when I came back to the US later on, this was in 2016, I moved to DC. And a lot of that space for me was juxtaposed with the rise of the Trumpian era. It was a couple months before Trump became the president of America. And I think I became so disillusioned by the world that I wanted to take action in my own hands. I've always been like a go-getter. I've always been someone that prioritizes social change. And I think I wanted to really align my creative powers and my creative practice with something bigger. And I realized the idea of community, the idea of collaboration is so substantial to the human experience. And oftentimes it's not something that is like inherent, especially in writing, because it's like we have the sort of, oh, we have the Shakespeare, or we have we have all these individual writers that how like they stand this test of time, but like they had a whole community behind him. And I think for me, Syllable was sort of an attempt to really claim meaning for myself and say like, I want to create meaning with other people. And I think the Caribbean Sky Islands, this is just to give you a background on it, but the Caribbean Sky Island project was really like, can we imagine together possible futures? Can we create a space where we are free, or we are wrestling with these deeper challenges that our society are facing, like climate, especially in the Caribbean world? So the Caribbean world was started when I was publishing Moco Magazine, a couple poems was published in Moco Magazine, and I reached out to the editor, Andre, and he was very excited about the idea of like really bringing people together and kind of creating a fictional world, especially Black Caribbean, people from Black Caribbean background, creating a speculative fictional world and then writing stories into it. For me, I always look at this sort of artist collective as very long-term, 10, 20 years. Can we have a world that brings people together? Can we have a mythology, a meaning structure that engages different like groups of people in the Caribbean, specifically in that world? And I think for me, I was so excited to work with Tanya Liburd. And she's a Caribbean writer, I believe, from the Let me see where she. I. She's from Trinidad and Tobago, and
Okay.
we worked with Celeste Rita Baker. She's from the Virgin Islands and resides in St. Thomas. And all three of us, we met for over 3 or 4 months, and we created a fantastical world. And
Oh, nice.
the world literally lifts up 4, 5 times, 6 times a year, to escape rising sea level and hurricanes, but also for Carnival, but also to charge up from the sun. It's like literally the islands fit into pieces like a puzzle, and together this sort of fragmented identity of what it means to be a Caribbean are brought together into one unified sort of the Sky Island world. So I think that really began a space to sort of prototype and imagine, like, how do we look differently outside of the family structure? How do we look differently in terms of or the mysticism and the pantheon of divinities that tie the islands? How do we create different types of genders? How do we uncover the natural world as a sort of symbiotic relationship? How do we reimagine education? I think a lot of, for me, was like, how do we create new structures and new systems that this current world perhaps has never imagined of? And I think for me, I find healing and I find community through world building. It's an act of protest. Like, I'm imposing my meaning onto this physical world, and I'm bringing people together collaboratively to co-create. So it kind of, like, for me, I think it's really challenging the paradigm of what it means to be a writer, and that it has to be collaborative. Like, we desperately need a collaborative. I think that's the future of the arts, and I feel like with the challenges that we're being faced, especially in the Caribbean, it's like it's so important, I feel like, for me.
You mentioned reimagining new structures and new systems, and here I want to talk about the mangoes.
Yes.
In Magic Mangoes, it uses a very co the common imagery of the mango, but in literature, it has been theorized the mango and other tropical fruits have been theorized as belonging to the folk, right? To the common person. And Derek Walker kind of gestured towards that. But how I want to know the inspiration for Magic Mangoes. You mentioned already the longing to be just to go outside in your backyard and pick a mango. What was your inspiration for writing that story, and what kinds of deeper challenges you were getting at, to use your phrase, and what kind of new systems we readers can take away from this?
Absolutely. I think mangoes symbolically serve so much. I feel like there's a, I always feel like there's different points, aesthetical points in my life. Like, and one of them is like picking up a mango, closing my eyes, and smelling it. And like, literally, by the act of smelling the mango, I can access memories that right now, this very moment, I'm not able to access to. So it's like the smell, the colors, the texture in my hands, it transports me back into the summers where there used to be hundreds of mangoes and trees in my backyard or trees in the neighborhood that would fall on the ground or birds would eat. Or there's a, such an aesthetic sort of origin story to for me to mango that I wanted to claim in that story, but I didn't really get the idea. I think it was from my niece, but when I was in Florida, and she picked up, I was kind of thinking and trying to figure out, because a lot of my kind of storytelling process is like I get sort of like, so I started as, I feel like my beginnings as an artist is very like, is a lot of poetry. And it's like the way that my poetry works is that I get sort of senses or sensibilities. It's like you have this sort of idea of the higher forms, the Platonic vision of like the perfect forms. It's like in a different dimension. There's a perfect geometrical form. And it's like every aspect of our existence, whether it's a car or house or tree, has a form of beauty that exists. Mm-hmm. And I think for me as a poet, like I tap into these things and it just smashes my consciousness and then stays mm-hmm. in me. And I have to sort of like write it down through the structure of words, A, B, C, D, like kind of do this sort of artistry with words. And I think it was a point a couple years ago where my niece had mangoes, fresh mangoes. And I think it was the first time in a while that I had seen like a young person who's like 3 to 4 years old, who's holding a mango. And I was like, wow, what if the mangoes were magic? And mm-hmm. I feel like a lot of my sort of aesthetic for writing those stories at this point is really about like, how do I look at young people discovering their own power? And how do I look at young Black people understanding their power and claiming their power or learning to engage their power and their magic? And I feel like a lot of the time we don't necessarily understand what power is and mm-hmm. how does power exist in the heart? How does power exist in the body? How does power exist in our minds? How does power exist in healing? How does power exist in process of doing in time and space? So I think for me, a lot of my writing has been sort of to explore how does a character, a Black character, step into their power and what do they do with that power? So I think in Magic Mangoes, it was a sort of multitude of different things where I wanted to look at specifically, because when we created the me, Tanya, and Celeste, when we created the Caribbean Sky Islands, we then invited Joan Hillhouse, she's from Antigua, Barbados, to write as a guest writer. But when we created it, we really imagined it to be a utopia. Where it's like it's led by this council of elders, and then there's a sort of a perfection that is imbued with like the natural world and the systems and the processes. But I wanted to go even further and say, what if the levels of magic that and the levels of power that the people in the society have access to were specifically sort of like kept down because having too much power might stifle their sort of utopian vision. And I wanted to explore in the Magic Mangoes, what would happen if a young Caribbean boy is sort of put into a situation where there's someone in the family is sick, but they are in communication with the God. They have a sort of divine visitation through their mm-hmm. dream. And they're able to sort of communicate with these deities. And then they're able to go beyond the sort of societal structure of utopia and kind of explore the past, the history, to inform their present and their future. And I feel like that particular story explored like a group of people in the Caribbean Sky Islands world that had sort of tapped into a new form of power, and because of that sort of power, they didn't really know how to use it, so they were kind of stuck. And I don't want to ruin the story for people, but like it's kind of looking at those frameworks and those paradigms.
Let's talk about the Golden Veins collection, because there's a lot going on, and I really wish we could talk about, because there's so much. But you're also doing this sort of time travel thing, very in keeping with some science fiction tropes. So, for example, in The Take, we have the transatlantic trade of enslaved West Africans going on, and then we take us to Saint-Domingue, which for those who are listening. Before Haiti got its name, that was the previous name. So this back and forth that you're doing, the bringing together the history and the futures, why was it important for you to show both these sides? And these these different representations.
Absolutely. I think my Haitian identity has been an incredible source of power, and at times I think too much power. because I also do claim that I'm American, and I also have hundreds of other identities that are sort of dancing and chanting and singing inside of me, sort of my wisdom system. And I do feel that a lot of those different voices came out through this collection. Yeah. And particularly the take, I have a knack for the supernatural horror, and I feel like that's something that is very natural to me. And that one, I wanted to explore, like, what if there was an alien abduction, literally an alien abduction, at the beginning of this modern transatlantic slave trade, and kind of following this this royal, like, queen that is sort of coming of age, but like this sort of her entire life is disrupted by this literal abduction, where the room is shaking, she's afraid, no one knows what's happening, everyone hears her screech because it's extremely painful. She rises up through the roof, and then there's literally a metallic spaceship that it takes her all the way up to the sky to a different world. And in doing that spaceship, those beings, those strange beings, what they're wanting to get from her is inside of her magic and her sort of her power. And this sort of the jewels and the wisdom and that is sort of manifested into a fantastical universe that is leaking from inside of her. And I feel like when she travels back, I wanted to kind of show I think there's many layers to it, because when she comes back and like she sees an old friend from her tribal community, but this old friend is like extremely old and sort of dilapidated, it's almost as if it's like there are double themes of like extraction. And I think a lot of it for me as well too is like being Black in this world, there's a lot of rage that is sort of imbued, and I will talk about that a little bit later with Medusa. But I feel like as a writer, that rage can be so sort of, it can be corrosive in a way. Mm-hmm. It can coerce my dignity. It can be corrosive to my soul. And it's almost as if I have to channel it through art. I have to transmute that through stories, through this sort of the magic of imagination, so I can sort of exist. And I feel like the Golden Vein sort of represents an era of my life where I was very much sort of dealing with what it meant to be Black, what it meant to be Caribbean in the world, what it meant to be a descendant of like the first independent Black country, what it meant to be sort of a French Caribbean background as well, specifically, because I've learned so much from the French canon and the French literature. So I think a lot of those stories kind of going back from the take or going back from the Golden Veins or Le Cap, I think all of these stories really represents like me reconciling with the irreconcilable of like this very dense energy that if I express it in other means in society could ultimately lead to my death.
Stay tuned for part 2 of my chat with Fabrice Guerrier and the Caribbean Science Fiction Network.